Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with experts on mental health training in schools and on federal cancer funding. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
the stigma behind mental health is waning, and the ability to discuss the topic and actually do something about it increases every year. Knowing how to self-care and manage one's mental health can be a daunting task, and most people here in Central Ohio believe mental health education is necessary both at schools, at home, and the workplace. But here's the problem. There's lingering doubt about the ability of the providers back on a perceived lack of training. That's what it's based on, a perceived lack of training. Raul Andrews Jr. is the executive director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
What are the primary mental health issues that have parents so concerned this school year?
So when I talk to our doctors and when we look at feedback from parents and family caregivers, we know that bullying and cyberbullying is one of the major concerns. We also know that anxiety about going back to school for whatever reason remains a tough situation. And then finally, when it comes to isolation, that even sometimes in our biggest schools, some of our student scholars feel isolated and alone, and they don't know how to ask for help or where to seek help.
So what is the Notice Talk Act at School program?
So the APA Foundation has a program that is funded by a grant that allows us to bring mental health training to all school staff, not just teachers, at no cost to the school, no cost to the parents, no cost to the teachers and staff. And what we're trying to do is have the stop, drop, and roll of mental health in the backpack as the school year begins.
Now, when it comes to attending school, students obviously interact with teachers. Sometimes they interact with staff. But that's not the limit of whom they interact with in the school. So, for example, how can a lunch lady or a janitor or a school bus driver participate in protecting a child's mental health?
And we believe that is the genius of the Notice Talk Act program at Notice Talk Act at School, because it's not limited to teachers it is and administrators. It is the whole school community is going to learn how to notice signs and symptoms of distress in students. They're going to be talking, which means that we're going to have courageous conversations about concerns around mental health or stress versus difficult conversations. And finally, when it comes to ACT, what we're going to know is what are the appropriate tools, tips, and resources to help our students and their families if they need help. That's how Stop, Drop, and Roll for Mental Health works. Notice, Talk, ACT at School.
It's one thing to notice, but it's another thing to get the student to actually talk. What are some of the ways that you've found are most successful to get the student who may be in some level of crisis to open up?
So there is a continuum that we find in the Notice Talk Act at School platform around trust and truth. And so if you blame or come at a student in a hard or a disciplinary way when they need empathy and caring and compassion, you're going to shut them down even further. So one of the things you want to do is make sure that you understand where that student is coming from. Everybody always talks, Jay, about meeting people where they are, but then they don't hang around long enough. So here's where we've seen it work. A school custodian is going in to check the restrooms. They see a child in there inconsolable, crying, and they may be, without the training, tiptoeing away when they could be saying, you know, I'm worried of what about what I'm seeing, and let's talk to the appropriate school personnel to see what's going on. Why is that child in there alone? You know, coaches, you know, instead of, you know, just asking for more, 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 faster, better, stronger, you know, being able to pull back because they see somebody is struggling on the team. And instead of adding pressure, we're releasing pressure.
Now, you talked about bullying, cyberbullying, anxiety, depression. How do we differentiate between the triggers that happen during the school day versus what the students bring in as baggage from their home situation?
So the good news is we're not going to make our educators doctors, right? So we're not asking to diagnose, and training doesn't do diagnosis. Again, we stay on this is the stop, drop, and roll of mental health. And so if we see behavior that looks like it's out of the ordinary for that student, that gives us a tell that we probably do need to reach out, or at least be open to reaching out. You know, we might read something in an essay, or we might see somebody in the cafeteria who's the life of the cafeteria now isolating themselves, or somebody who's the star of the football team all of a sudden decides to quit. Is that normal for that particular student? So we just want to make sure we're looking for signs and symptoms of atypical behavior. And if it's atypical behavior, then trying to do further inquiry from a compassionate way about what's going on so we can figure out what help is needed.
Now, teen suicide is at an all-time high, especially within the LGBT community. And recent changes in the direction of our federal and even some state governments have made that even worse. At what point do we move into the suicide prevention conversation, and how do we implement Notice, Talk, Act to prevent that?
The APA Foundation is working with any number of organizations, including the Defensive Line and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, among others, to make sure that we're bringing appropriate resources to the table. But if you don't notice that things are out of the ordinary, we are going to miss something that might happen that might save a child's life. We already know that over 2 out of every 5 of our high school students is in a persistent state of despair and hopelessness. So we have to understand when we come back to school that there's a challenge going on. We also know that for our girls, for example, between 10 and 24, they have written suicide plans, Jay. Mm. That doesn't mean they're taking action. And for our young boys, they may not write anything, but when they decide to hurt themselves, they use the most violent means possible. But we didn't notice. So we didn't know how to have the conversation to talk, and then we don't know how to bring the tools, tips, and resources to take the appropriate action. So that's why we want people to go to apaf.org/schools and check out our resource and figure out if this is the kind of platform that needs to come to your school, or if you're a educator and you're like, you know what, we don't have budget for this. Knowing about this free resource that is grant-funded, we already know your governor thinks that mental health is a serious concern, and we know he's launched a task force. What better way to support that task force that your governor has put in place than to say, let's look at Notice, Talk, Act as one of the components, as one of the tools in the toolkit for this coming school year.
Now, if the school's not doing it themselves, can parents bring this to the table at the school?
Absolutely. Everybody can lift their voice, and the parents don't need permission slips to say, why aren't we doing this? This is our tax dollars at work to make Notice, Talk, Act at school a reality. And so go to apaf.org/schools, and you'll have the resource. And if the parents are not comfortable reaching out and carrying that information directly to the school, they can reach out to us through the apaf.org website, and we'll contact the school on their behalf.
What happens after the initial training, Roel? Is there continuing education so that we continue to update these people on what's new?
There's not only continuing education, there's continuing polling to see how you are before as an educator in terms of your comfort level with the platform. And then there's a continuum of further education. More importantly than that, though, Jay, we have a train the trainer model, which has really worked well in some states, where, and particularly that state up north. And what they've been able to do is, instead of having us come to you, which we'll again do at no cost, you train somebody inside the school community to be your team captain. And we continue to feed them that information, and then they can use their own cultural tools and resources to augment the training and supplement it.
Now, I should have asked you this at the beginning, but it's not too late. How long has this program been in operation?
So we've been doing this for almost 8 years, and the federal funding piece came about 4 years ago. And so one of the things, again, this is your tax dollars at work. Why not put those resources back into the communities where it matters most? And that's where we think, again, Notice Talk Act at School can really make a difference. And we've seen it make a difference when it comes to truancy. We've seen Notice Talk Act at School make a difference when it comes to disciplinary referrals. But we've also seen that training provide a warm blanket to the educator community, right? Because now I'm comfortable talking about something that used to be difficult.
Well, and also we want to see the, you know, quantifiable outcome, because we want to see things like substance abuse, domestic violence, you know, domestic terrorism and suicide rates drop among our school student population. Is there some study that you guys have done that addresses some of those metrics?
So, again, we have the resources. If you go to apaf.org/schools, you will see our research. This is an evidence-based model that has been endorsed by our doctors, our physician psychiatrists at the American Psychiatric Association. And so the nice thing about it is it's got a database, but it also is humanistic and compassionate enough that you don't have to be a doctor to take the class, and you don't have to be a doctor to understand the content. We're not making medical doctors here. We're making better educators for better tomorrows.
We want to thank Raul Andrews Jr. for being with us on this most important subject. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
The federal government has earmarked the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute for significant budget cuts of up to 40%, making it one of the most significant funding cuts in decades. Federally funded cancer research has fueled nearly every major advancement in cancer care over the past 50 years and contributed to progress in other areas of medicine. Today, more than 18 million Americans are alive thanks to federally funded cancer research, screening, and prevention. If these cuts are implemented, it will be devastating to the pace and progress of cancer research in our country. Dr. Julie Greilau is the Chief Medical Officer and Executive Vice President of the American Society of Clinical Oncology and joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss what the proposed changes could mean for patients and providers and how the scientific community may be affected. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. What types of cancer research are typically supported by this federal funding?
Well, lots of types of research, it fills an unmet need. Some of the most important research is what we call the basic or foundational research. It's the research about what causes cancer, what takes a normal cell and what happens to it that makes it become a cell that can spread and grow and divide. How does the cancer cell evade the immune system? This is the foundational research that's frequently done in a lab that then leads to insights that can ultimately lead to new treatment approaches. But that basic research is generally what is funded by the NIH. We also fund, through the National Cancer Institute, a large clinical trial network that patients essentially in all 50 states can enroll in. These are trials that are designed generally comparing the current standard of care with some new proposed potentially better. better treatment. The only way we can do the comparison is to do trials, and the NCI supports those. It also supports research into rare cancers, uncommon cancers, where there's not a big financial incentive if you have something approved there, because there's not a large population that will use the drug. That includes like pediatric cancers as well. And then, you know, trials that are looking at lower doses that decrease toxicity, or supportive care, surgical approaches, those are things that are generally funded by federal government funds.
I haven't heard anything bad yet. Why would they want to stop the funding? It makes no sense.
Well, we're looking for how can we be more efficient? How can we, reduce spending so that we can reduce taxes? But I will tell you that we've had strong bipartisan support in Congress for cancer research funding for decades. And actually, some good news is that despite the fact that the president's budget proposal called for that 40% cut to the NIH and the National Cancer Institute, the Senate committee actually late in August approved a bill that would increase funding, not cut the 40% cut that's been proposed in the president's budget, but actually slightly increase funding for the NIH and the NCI. And it's Congress that ultimately decides the budget. So we've got until September 30th to come together to pass a bill funding the federal government, and there will be lots of negotiations going on. But cancer affects us all. It is not a partisan issue.
How could this funding reduction affect patients and providers? And I already have an inkling as to what you're going to say, but for the audience, they need to hear it too.
Well, I think it will greatly slow the next breakthroughs that come along. If we're not investing in the science and the research and the clinical trials, the pace of the breakthroughs will be much slower. We'll have less clinical trials to offer patients. We'll have less tools available to us to help in treating the cancer. And also, it's going to result, if we have these big cuts, in what we call a brain drain, where our oncologists and our cancer researchers will leave the country. They're already being recruited by other countries. There are ads out there saying, come to Germany, we'll support you. And the early career researchers, I've seen this with some of my own colleagues, will choose to go into another field. And so we will lose the researchers, and we will lose those who are treating cancer. And that can majorly impact patients as well.
If the role of the NIH and the NCI is disrupted, and that's a nice term to use, I can think of a few others I'd like to use, but if it's disrupted, is someone else going to step up? For example, would a major hospital system like the Cleveland Clinic increase their role in these efforts or not?
Well, I think they will try as best they can, but the amounts of money that we're talking about are not amounts of money that in an already stressed healthcare system that hospitals or academic institutions are going to be able to come with these amounts of money. I was on a call with a colleague at a major academic institution just yesterday, and they are working out these contingency plans that would involve lots of staff layoffs and firings and lots of projects that won't continue, even though they're trying to rearrange their money somewhat. They just cannot make up that gap. Nobody can make up that gap. Private philanthropy does not have that kind of money. Industry, it will pursue their own projects and their own interests, but those will be projects that are designed to get drugs approved and get them used. And a lot of what I told you the NIH and NCI funding covers is not directly related to a financial payout. It's the background work.
So earlier you said that there was a chance that this might not happen, and in fact something more positive might happen in Congress on or about September 30th. What's the likelihood that Congress will say, let's leave cancer alone?
It's very hard in this environment to predict anything. I would say that we believe we have strong support from many of our congresspeople, but this is the time for your listeners to contact their members of Congress and tell them how important it is to support federal cancer research funding. Give personal stories when they hear from their constituents about the importance of this and how their lives have been impacted by the research in cancer or their family members' lives. It really makes a difference, right? So contact your congressional representatives now before the September 30th. While all this is going on, there are a lot of competing priorities. We're trying to raise us to the top.
What was the old adage that cancer is like a less than 2-degree separation from every individual in the United States? Is that about right?
I would say almost all of us, depending on how you're defining the degree of separation, have a family member or a friend or a coworker who's been impacted by cancer. So I would say it's not even 2 degrees of separation.
If listeners want to learn more about the subject or, you know, find ways to make a difference, what is the best website for them to go to?
Well, on our website, we have more information with some of the statistics you can use in talking to your congressional reps. It's at asco.org, that's O-R-G, /save research.
asco.org/save research. Got it.
Right.
Well, under better circumstances, we'll talk again, Dr. Julie, but I wish you all the best in your endeavors. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The politically motivated killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk continues to dominate the national conversation. Ohio political leaders are condemning political violence in any form, even introducing legislation against it and joining hands across the aisle to address it. A question many people are pondering is what to do about political violence. How do you stop it? Two Ohio lawmakers think they have a way to protect people who are speaking their minds, making laws, and reporting the news. They just introduced a bill to strengthen penalties for politically motivated violence. The bill's sponsors say the killing of Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband earlier this year was a shock to lawmakers on the state level, only reinforced by the public assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. So they say they had to do something.
You think about an assassination, I never thought of a state level politician, but to see that happen was a bit of a it was a gut check for a lot of us.
That shook us to our core as legislators.
This year, first Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband were shot and killed in their home. Then conservative activist Charlie Kirk gunned down in front of a large crowd on a college campus.
When we saw the actual murder of Charlie Kirk, we wanted to make sure that we added on that, you know, political motivation will elevate to aggravated murder.
In response to the violence, Daniels and Williams decided to take action with the tool they have, legislation. They just introduced a bill strengthening penalties for politically motivated violence.
If we can prove your intentions are politically motivated, either by your political views or the political views of your victim, then you are going to receive a very, very harsh penalty here in the state of Ohio.
The bill would elevate politically motivated murder to aggravated murder. It would carry a mandatory sentence of life without parole, and the crime would be eligible for the death penalty. It applies to elected officials, their staffs, journalists, and activists peacefully exercising their First Amendment rights.
My fear is that political violence will silence the most important voices, the people who want to say the difficult things, the people who want to challenge the public norms.
Daniels says he has not received any threats. Williams says he has received death threats.
How do you deal with that and keep doing your job?
Much like Charlie Kirk, I have great faith in my Lord and Savior that, you know, I'm doing the job that he assigned for me, and I'm doing good work, and there's always going to be opponents. So I'm not going to let someone intimidate me to the point where I stop doing my job that I was elected to do.
There should be no fear to get on a soapbox in any arena and say how you feel. The physical violence part of it should never have to be considered by anyone, and I hope that we as a country can return to that.
The two representatives point out political violence has been carried out on people on both sides of the aisle, and it needs to stop. They hope their bill moves quickly through the legislature. It's waiting for its first hearing. The killings of Charlie Kirk and Melissa Hortman and her husband prompted Ohio leaders on both sides of the aisle to join forces to condemn political violence. Republican State Senate President Rob McCauley and Speaker of the House Matt Huffman, along with Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio and House Minority Leader Dunny Isaacson, released a joint statement. The statement in full reads, "In a free and democratic society, there's absolutely no place for politically motivated violence, nor should anyone encourage or celebrate this type of heinous criminal behavior. As leaders from different sides of the aisle, we felt it was vital to join together to emphasize the significance of this message as we strongly condemn the assassinations of Charlie Kirk and Minnesota lawmaker Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark Hortman, earlier this year. A free democracy depends on the open and peaceful exchange of ideas. Political violence destroys the bedrock upon which that freedom of expression is built. When we are worried that our words or viewpoints might lead to political violence, we are no longer able to speak our minds or advocate for our priorities. At the most basic level, we must put into practice a belief in each other's humanity. We are people, fathers and mothers, sons and daughters, Ohioans and Americans, before we are anything else. The future of our country depends on never forgetting that basic fact. Now more than ever, we must encourage respectful dialogue, starting here in the legislature, across both political parties, to bring about a brighter, more peaceful future here in Ohio." I caught up with Governor Mike DeWine and gubernatorial candidates Democrat Amy Acton and Republican Vivek Ramaswamy this past week as well. I asked all of them their message after the killing of Charlie Kirk. They all denounced violence of any kind. Here's what else they said.
"We have an obligation, those of us in public office have an obligation to denounce any kind of violence from the right, the left, the middle, whoever it is. Violence has no place in our political process, absolutely no place."
"It's so important that we don't give up on one another. People are intentionally pitting us against one another over and over again, but what people are longing for is to find their way back to their neighbor, find their way back to their family member who maybe doesn't agree with what they believe. We can't give up on one another."
"We're not a country where you kill somebody because you disagree with them. That's not America. Words are not violence. Violence is violence. And violence is never an acceptable response to words. And I think most people, whether you're Democrat or Republican in this state, actually agree with that. It is a tiny fringe that's at risk of destroying that culture of peace and nonviolence in our country. And we have to say that's not who we are."
Governor DeWine said the fact that Kirk was killed on a college campus makes his death more poignant because he was there encouraging young people to get involved in politics and public issues. On Wednesday, Ohio State President Ted Carter gave his State of the University address. 10TV's Jeff Hogan sat down with him for a wide-ranging interview. University safety came up in the wake of the Charlie Kirk shooting. And Jeff asked Carter, "Where are we in this moment?"
"I think people are looking for some leadership in this moment in time, and leadership centered around how we can better unify ourselves, still let our voices be heard from all the different constituents that are here on a campus, a public university campus like Ohio State, but also make sure that we help educate our students, faculty, and staff to understand how to let their voices be heard, how to have, you know, a disagreement without it turning into it's either my idea or no other idea available."
10TV is staying on top of the investigation of Charlie Kirk's assassination and the response to it. You can download the 10TV app to get the latest updates on the shooting suspect's case. You can also check our website, 10TV.com, and watch our newscasts on 10TV+.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Ohio's number one industry took center stage in a huge way. Anything and everything you could possibly want to know or learn about agriculture was featured at a massive location in Madison County. Ohio State University's 63rd anniversary Farm Science Review was held at the Molly Caron Agricultural Center in London. It featured more than 600 vendors, the latest and greatest in farming technology and innovation, as well as workshops and learning opportunities on a wide range of agriculture topics. Governor DeWine says the Farm Science Review is all about the future. Farmers can learn about new techniques and technology, and nearly 10,000 high school students might find their career path.
These are FFA kids. These are kids who, you know, may see their future in farming, but it may be in something related to farming, something to do with food, other things in regard to agriculture. So giving them that opportunity, I think, is just a really, really great thing.
More than 100,000 people visit the Farm Science Review every year. Well, it comes at a time when you may be experiencing some beef price sticker shock. Yeah, bad news if you love hamburgers and steak. The price of beef is sizzling, up 14% compared to this time last year. As 10TV's Carlo Rogner learned, it's a classic case of low supply and high demand, and don't expect these prices to go down anytime soon.
What are you noticing with the prices?
It's doubled.
There's no question about it. Shoppers are paying more for beef at the grocery store.
It's mostly chicken now.
Yeah.
And I'm getting tired of chicken.
But those who don't want to shell out extra cash for beef might be eating chicken a while longer.
This is a boneless beef ribeye.
At Falter's Meatpacking, their wholesale prices for beef have gone up astronomically.
Instead of paying in the neighborhood of $12 a pound early last year, you're now looking at 18 to 20 before you do any of the work required to turn it into steaks.
According to the USDA, there were about 45 million beef cattle in 1975, compared to about 29 million today. Despite fewer cows available, Jason Falter says people are not changing their diets.
And in fact, we've seen steady to higher demand over the past few years.
The prices forcing local restaurants to beef up their creativity.
You're going to see some interesting things like chicken in chili. We noticed that we were their Skyline friends, and they now have a chicken chili that they're testing. And so you might see more things like that.
So if you're going out to eat, should you be prepared to pay higher prices for beef items on the menu?
Yeah, I think you're going to be prepared to pay a higher price for beef items. There's going to be a few exceptions to that. I think that you might see some of the quick serve restaurants, particularly the big chains, be able to kind of get through this easier than maybe our mom and pop and independent restaurants.
Restaurants are prepared for prices to stay high through at least 2027. But even still, people are opting for the beef.
People like their beef, right? And I just don't see that changing. And so the demand, I think, is going to stay high.
Here at Falter's, they're already looking ahead to the holiday season where they're expecting high demand for beef. That means prices could go up even more. Reporting in Columbus, Carla Rogner, 10TV News.
Candidates for Ohio governor, Democrat Dr. Amy Acton and Republican Vivek Ramaswamy both made appearances at the Farm Science Review. I asked them what they would do if elected governor to support the agriculture industry in Ohio.
One of the things I've been doing as a candidate for governor is going everywhere in the state, listening deeply. I've been spending a lot of time, actually, particularly around kitchen tables with women in agriculture on both sides of the aisle. Women own farms, they inherit farms, they do the books, they run the 4-H. And what I'm hearing from them is that some of the biggest issues they are facing are costs. Right now, a big issue in the ag community is being able to keep property and inherit property and have someone be able to maintain it, because property taxes are so high right now, keeping the community going that way. Healthcare is a huge, huge issue. Many people have to work a second job off of the farm just to have health insurance. Mental health is a very, very big issue on farms right now with all the stresses that folks face. Another big issue, actually, is public schools. Schools are top of mind in many communities. It's a big part of the way of life. And and people feel like that is not being fully funded and cared for as well. And finally, I just think there's a lot of unusual stresses right now with the economy. Right now, soybeans particularly, so I'm hearing a lot of that.
And we just did a story yesterday about beef prices being up 14%. Not really anything you can do about that, I guess, in particular, but how can you support the beef farmers here?
Well, there's a lot, absolutely so much that we can do at this state, but one of the biggest things I will say is that we have to empower communities again and empower local communities. There's a ton. We're here at the Science Review. There are so many experts in this area, and one of the things I'm hearing from a lot of them is they want the legislature and a governor to listen deeply to the needs of the community. This is so much a way of our life. We don't want to lose that here in Ohio and the values that everyone holds dear. So I would say, you know, a governor has a really important role to play, and something that is the second largest GDP issue in Ohio.
So look, it's our oldest industry, and I think it is our biggest industry to this day. We got to build on that foundation and double down on making sure agriculture remains at the heart of Ohio's economy and Ohio's agricultural capital across the country and across the world. Now, to do that, some common sense principles. We've got to think about property taxation, which is an issue in this state that's burdening a lot of landowners. Farmers are included in that. Keep CAUV intact. I'm in favor of it. Think about actually also the next generation of farmers. We got to have more of them cultivated right here in our state. Integrate ag and exposure to ag even in the high school curriculum to be able to have younger people see this as a viable career option that they find as actually attractive. And one of the things I've loved about the farmers in our state is they've also been very proactive in taking on the water quality issues that we all care about. H2 Ohio and their engagement through that's been incredible. But at the same time, I don't think farmers should be solely having to shoulder that burden on themselves either. And that's an important conversation for us to have going forward. And then veterinary medicine is an important opportunity too. And we have a great College of Veterinary Medicine at Ohio State. I was actually with a number of veterinary medicine leaders last night. And one of the things I talked to them about is how 1 + 1 = 3 in this domain, right? There's good synergies from strong veterinary medicine in Ohio and cultivating young veterinarians in our state to also help support our livestock farmers and ag more generally. The way I think about that, it's all common sense. Right? Nothing that I told you I don't think is particularly about Democrats versus Republicans. It's not about right versus left. It's about right versus wrong. And we choose up versus down for the state of Ohio.
Also last week, Ohio State President Ted Carter gave his State of the University speech. He addressed his plans for the future of education. It's called Education for Citizenship 2035. 10TV's Kristen McFarland was there and has more on his message.
Year after year, the Ohio State University continues to grow, bringing in the best students from all over.
I love Ohio State.
Striving to be the best doesn't happen by accident. It demands careful planning and consistent hard work. That's why OSU President Ted Carter is laying out the roadmap for the next decade.
We are in a position to invest in ourselves, take ourselves to that next level.
Academic excellence, world-class, clinical care, and student affordability. These are the top three priorities Carter outlined. One of those initiatives dedicated to preparing students for the ever-evolving landscape of artificial intelligence. Carter wants to give every student the opportunity to become fluent in AI.
Nobody else in the country is even attempting it. This will require us to get our faculty up to speed on AI.
And as artificial intelligence becomes more intertwined with our daily lives, current students are looking ahead too.
I think all of us are like a little fearful with how AI will impact our careers in the future. And so I think knowing how to manipulate it to our own use and like to benefit us is like a nice security to have.
Securing strong careers for students is a priority for Carter. He wants every undergraduate student to get a paid internship during their time as a Buckeye. Junior McKenna Parker says internships have given her invaluable experience.
I'm on like my third or fourth internship right now for interior design, and I feel like I have a lot of the knowledge that I need for the professional world, and I feel confident going into interviews.
President Carter says the continued success of the university will require a dedicated and relentless community working together.
Carter also talked about expanding the nursing program at OSU amid a nationwide nursing shortage. He emphasized his goal to more than double the number of nurses the university produces over the next decade. The battle over Ohio's political maps will officially start inside the State House. Last week, outside the State House, hundreds of advocates rallied to try to make sure the new congressional maps will truly represent the people of Ohio. Carrying signs saying "Fair Maps Now," "Stop Gerrymandering," and "We Love the Constitution," the crowd first marched to the State House, then completely encircled it, holding hands or holding signs between them. Their message to lawmakers is straightforward: draw fair congressional district maps. Democrats have proposed a map they call fair and constitutional based on voter preference over the last 10 years. Right now, Republicans hold 10 of Ohio's 15 congressional seats. The Democrats' proposal has 8 districts now leaning red and 7 leaning blue. Republicans have not yet proposed a map of their own. The Joint Committee on Congressional Redistricting is made up of 8 Republicans and 4 Democrats. There's a new initiative designed to improve early childhood literacy. It's now easier than ever for parents to sign up for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. First Lady of Ohio Fran DeWine recently announced the option to sign up is now part of the Ohio birth certificate paperwork process. The Imagination Library sends a free book to kids every month from their birth to their 5th birthday. Any Ohio parent can sign up their child for free. To sign up, head to the Imagination Library's website, ohioimaginationlibrary.org.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.